Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show, lots of good people involved. And its host and founder is Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. And let's kick the program off today with Carol in conversation with David Bedrick. He's an expert in mediation and conflict resolution, and he's going to talk to Carol about his new book titled Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. It's published by Belly Song Press.
So, David Bedrick, the warmest of welcomes to A Touch of Grey.
Thank you so much. I'm really impressed with the work you're doing, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Now, you said pop culture only serves to inflame people's already critical sensibilities. How does it do that? And why isn't it helpful when you're trying to help people change their behavior?
Well, pop psychology has a Dr. Phil mentality. Dr. Phil says things like, what are you thinking? And things that make one feel like that if you could change your thinking quickly, or if you could look at yourself differently, you could make a difference. And it tends not to work that way. People often feel ashamed of themselves when they're looked at as if something is wrong with them, as if something incredible is inside of them.
And that makes people very defensive. Now, your book tackles a wide range of problems that people can experience, and on each topic you offer a new psychological take, which is really compared to the approach of Dr. Phil's. So let's start with dieting and body image. You talk about the fact that Dr. Phil had a show where he had brides who wanted to lose 40 to 60 pounds a number of months before their wedding came on the show, and he offered them an incentive to lose weight. What was the incentive, and what was wrong with it?
Well, the incentive was that they would get a wedding dress in a size that was significantly smaller than their current size. So you have to imagine this, Carol. Imagine that you took a group of women. I know a number of women, including my partner and wife, and if I put her on a stage and then put her next to another woman, and then I and an audience agreed that another woman was more attractive than her, she would either walk off the stage or later on feel terrible. It's a kind of a public shaming event. People would take that as a motivation, but it often isn't. In fact, people often do this to themselves. They look in the mirror, or they put on some clothes, or step on a scale, and they say, oh, I ought to look different. I ought to be thinner. But that particular lens, whether that's true or not, whether they ought to be or not, that lens that criticizes one's body and body image almost never helps a person actually lose weight, even though that's what sends people to a diet program.
So what is a better way to change our behavior about what we eat if we want to lose weight? For instance, what would you ask someone who loves to gorge on, say, Ben and Jerry's ice cream? What would you ask her to find out why she loves to eat it?
Well, I would say to her, before she gets motivated to try to stop eating that, although that's okay, but it just tends not to be successful, I would say, could you tell me what it's like to eat Ben and Jerry's ice cream? Which flavor do you like? And she might say, well, it's bad for me. And I'd say, I understand that. We'll get to the help towards your not eating it. But what is it like? And people will describe different things. Are you a Ben & Jerry's ice cream eater by chance?
Yes.
Okay. What's your favorite flavor?
Oh, I like them all. But
You like them all. And do you eat it at specific times or whenever you can? Or
whenever I can. I try to temper it by not going out and getting it.
I see. Right. The tempering thing makes sense. We all ought to do that. But can I ask you one more question?
Mm-hmm.
If you had a spoonful of Ben and Jerry's ice cream right now, or an ice cream cone, would you get a cone or would you get a cup?
Cup.
Okay. And imagine tasting that Ben and Jerry's ice cream. What does it taste like to you?
It's so creamy, and I love the name, and I associate it with good things.
It's creamy.
Yes, I love the way
you said creamy.
If
I were to go further with you, we won't have time to do all that in the moment. If I were to go further with you, the creaminess that's something that's a really interesting quality because, Carol, you said it like this. I'm going to exaggerate a little bit for the sake of the audience. You said creamy.
That's the way I feel about it. Yeah.
That's right. So that particular quality, I would say it like this, Carol. Creamy. That's a smoothing, softening aspect of things. So I would support then you are, I don't know much about you, I know only from what I've read. It seems like you're a relatively ambitious woman who has rich goals for lots of people.
Right.
Smoothing, being creamier, that would be a different way of necessary living than the pushing ahead. That might need some more support for you. So I would say not just make your day a nicer day, make it a creamier day. Make your relationships creamier, if I can say that. Now, we'd have to talk about what that would look like, but I'd want to make your whole day have a little bit more Ben and Jerry's to it. That means a creamier experience.
Thank you, thank you. I'm going to take that to heart.
Now,
why do you say, David, that you really have to give up the idea of dieting to lose weight?
Well, like I said, because almost everyone, especially women, diet out of a sense of displeasure, criticism with themselves. People could say they want to be healthier, but if you listen to the voices inside people's heads, and I've done that by asking them to say them out loud, they're awful and disgusting, brutal. People not only say I'm ugly and fat and things like that, but they say awful things to themselves. So it goes something like this, Carol. So a person sits there, looks at themselves, and criticizes themselves profusely and says, go to a diet program. David, go to a diet program. My inner voice might say, you look terrible. No one's going to love you. How can you go out like that? Something says that. It says, go to a diet program. But then as soon as I feel a little bit better about myself, I want to say to that voice that sends me to the diet program, hey, you know, I might say some things that I wouldn't say on air, right? Back off. I'm not interested in being put down by you anymore. So you get that yo-yo effect. The thing that sends me to the program is kind of negative and critical. And if I felt better about myself, I wouldn't take it. So then people go back and forth. So how do you then begin? You have to begin not by saying, I should lose weight. You have to begin by saying, what is it I'm doing, like with your ice cream example. And people always have deep and rich meanings for what they do. People are never doing things, almost never, I should say, just because they're stupid or lazy or undisciplined. That's just not true.
And you have a wonderful story in your book about addiction. It involves a woman in her 50s who smoked marijuana with her husband. And doesn't it show also, again, that the reasons most people give for using a substance are not at all connected to the real benefit they get from it?
Exactly. She said she smoked marijuana because she had a good time. And many people would say, well, that makes sense. I understand that. Let's figure out other ways for you to have a good time that somehow take the marijuana from you. That's good. Eventually we want her to stop doing the substance. I'm agreeing with that. But then I say to her, can you tell me what it's like smoking marijuana? And again, she says, well, I have a good time. I said, yes, tell me exactly what happens, just like I was trying to do with you in the ice cream in short measure here. And then she said, well, when I smoke marijuana, I don't really feel anything. I said, well, that's interesting. She said, but my husband, she says, he gets really stoned, she tells me. And I said, how do you know? And she said, he looks smaller to me. So that, of course, I had a bunch of a good laugh with her because I don't know that it really shrinks people, actually. But she saw it that way. And this was a woman who felt small in her life, especially relative to her husband. She felt a very disempowered person. So here she smokes marijuana, and what happens? She sees him as smaller. That makes her have a good time. Why? Because it feels a lot better to be bigger than someone that you always feel smaller than. So even though her idea in her mind is that she does it for fun, and if she went to some program, she would say, I have fun and I like it, and they would say, okay, we have to find other ways. It wasn't about being happier that she was looking for. She was looking to feel her own size. So her program, her addiction program, started out with helping her feel bigger as a person, her personality, her intellect, her creative capacities. There were a lot of big things inside of her that she kept small. Marijuana gave her a tiny little taste of what it's like to not be a small person.
You know, it makes so much sense. Now, all too often, we let our anger get out of control. And you have a chapter about looking at anger as a wild beast. What does mainstream psychology tell us we need to do when it comes to controlling our anger? And why did you use boiling water and actually the lid on the pot to illustrate why always suppressing anger can lead to bad results in the future. Good chapter.
Thank you very much. What happens with anger is it's scary. It's scary for the people around. If I'm an angry person or I get angry, then people around me might get scared, and I might get frightened because I don't want to hurt somebody. So there's an instant impulse, as mainstream psychology often has, is a suppressive one. Can I help you manage, keep that anger down? Which, by the way, has an intelligence to it. If I was hurting my partner or children, somebody would want to suppress me, right? Maybe they have to jail me if I did things really bad. Somehow keep me away from hurting people. But long term, outside of that keeping me away from people, that tends not to help because anger has a certain power and force in it. So as you were mentioning, it's like a boiling pot of water, and then someone says, well, what should I do about that? Well, we put a lid on it. And then that lid keeps that boiling pot of water in until that pressure builds up too much. Then it explodes. We call that having a bad temper. Someone says, I have a bad temper. I have to learn not to be angry. But the truth is, in that situation I just described, the problem wasn't the boiling water as much as a lid that's way too tight. For instance, if I'm a person, and I've had clients like this, who could never stand up for himself, even in mild ways. Let's say my wife wants to go out and have Italian food, and I want to have Chinese food, and I don't ever even feel comfortable saying that much. I hold everything in. Then that builds a certain heat, and then I might pop my lid and hurt her, or hurt somebody, or yell, or make some kind of, or get into a mood, or get resentful, as opposed to just saying, hey, could we do what I want tonight? That little statement, can I do what I want tonight, might take a little bit of heat for me, because I'm so unused to speaking up for myself. So it's not such a bad thing if it comes out on a regular basis. But if it doesn't, it tends to be very difficult and problematic.
That's David Bedrick in conversation with Carol Marks. His website is talkingbacktodrphil.com, and that's the name of the book, Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology, published by Belly Song Press. Carol Marks returns in conversation with Mary Higgins Clark when A Touch of Gray continues.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy and you feel fine. But that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Doesn't always cause symptoms, but it can be prevented. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here's the host of the program, Carol Marks. In conversation now with Mary Higgins Clark, one of the most beloved storytellers of our time and a perennial New York Times bestseller. She's going to talk to Carol about her new novel titled Daddy's Gone A-Hunting. It's published by Simon & Schuster.
You're known as the Queen of Suspense, and if you had to say, what do you think makes your books worldwide bestsellers, as they certainly are?
Well, I think it's my dead mother's prayers. Unfortunately, she only lived to see me write the first book, which was the George Washington one. But I think I have always said, let others decide whether or not I'm a good writer. I do know that I'm a good storyteller. And I do think that a writer has to be a storyteller. Make you want to turn the pages. Make you want to get back to the book when you have to put it down. And that is what is essential. And years ago, Isaac the Shaver Singer, he accepted an award from the Mystery Writers of America because he had said that he loved to read suspense. And when he spoke, what he said said it all as far as I was concerned. I do not care how eloquent your phrases, how polished your prose, unless you are a storyteller, you are not a writer. He said, in medieval times, the storyteller went from castle to castle. He began with the magical words, once upon a time, and everyone went shh and drew closer to the fire.
Absolutely. Perfectly said. Now, I want to talk about your latest mystery, Daddy's Gone A-Hunting. It's about two cases of young women whose murders many years ago never got solved. So how did you come up with the idea of using these types of crimes, what we now call cold cases, as important focal points of your plot?
Well, because I don't think there's anything worse than not knowing what happened to someone. Bad as it may be, if a young girl goes out and on her way to a friend's house to do the homework or watch a show together and something happens to her and her body is found, that's terrible. But if she just never shows up, then you think, is somebody hurting her? Is she being kept in some sort of cage somewhere? What happened? Did she lose her memory? What happened? And you never have any peace. And that's why I thought in this book, I want to have one girl who disappears like that and the other one who is found, but you don't know what happened to her. Where was she when she was killed? A young college student. So that has always been, to me, really, where are the children? Two children went missing. And that to me is the scariest thing in the world, the missing. The
you are so right. And you know, your mysteries also often feature topics that are in the news, and one of the characters that's considered to be the possible murderer of one of the cold case victims, he's a homeless alcoholic suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome due to his wartime experiences in Vietnam. And it's so topical because today many of our veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are experiencing PTS.
They are experiencing it. And when I was a little kid, there was a man who had been in World War I, and he was then in his mid-40s. And obviously, that's what his problem was. They called it shell shock in those days because he would walk a certain pattern every day. He would cross at exactly the same corner. He would never step on grass. He would always do anything to avoid having to step on grass. And the poor man, he was quiet. He hardly ever said anything. But I remember as a little kid, when Neil came down the block, he lived with his sister and her family, all the little kids sort of watched to see if he'd ever change his pattern. And I thought it was the saddest thing when you grow up. And we just had a case in New York where a cop bought shoes for a homeless man, and it turns out he wasn't homeless. He has shoes. He has an apartment, actually, but he likes to sit out and beg, and he was damaged during the war. So these cases exist, and they're in the headlines, and they're in the streets where you go down the block and see them, where for some reason people choose to live in the streets and they just can't live even with people who love them. And I think psychologically it makes a strong writing material.
Oh, it does. It was very moving. And you write such intricately woven stories. Is it ever difficult to keep the strands together and make them connect in the end? Because you have a lot of characters in this book, and I kept guessing that this one might be the bad one and that one might be the bad one. So how do you manage to bring it all together in the end?
Well, of course, it's all twine, you know. It's all long strings, and they must come out even in the end. I mean, the book, you know, if it takes 50 pages to explain that this one did it because the mailman happened to see him drive that guy down the block, then that book is a failure. It has to start to, one string is found, and then the next, and the next, and the next, until you finally get to the end where the climax scene reveals the final element of truth. And at that time, someone is in danger.
And you couldn't be a more successful writer than you presently are. So have you ever thought about cutting back?
Well, I would miss writing if I thought I couldn't tell a story. If I thought this book is just that doesn't work, I wouldn't put it out. I honestly wouldn't. But so far, so good. And I enjoy the writing process. Once I get about 50 pages finished, then the people take over the book, the people who are in it. They say things I didn't expect them to say. They walk out of the scene and I say, hey, wait a minute, come on back. You have to say this. He says, no. Give that line to her. That's her line, not mine. And that's when writing is fun. That's when I just can't wait to get back up the next morning, read the last 10 or 12 pages to get myself back into, you know, the scene. And then I say, okay, kids, what kind of trouble shall we get in today? And I get going.
And then I've got to say, hearing you say that you've got to be working on another mystery thriller that will be out next April, so all your fans really will have something to look forward to.
Well, I'm writing it now, and I'm having fun doing it.
Mary Higgins Clark, in conversation with Carol Marx. Her new book is titled Daddy's Gone A-Hunting. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We'll have more A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, coming your way in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor seat, and we're joined at this point in the program by our senior correspondent and special feature guest, Kevin Casey. Kevin Casey is the vice president and executive editor of the trade publication Talkers that serves the talk radio industry, which, of course, this radio station and yours truly, and actually all of you listening to this are part of as talk radio listeners. Kevin, I would say that the Boston bomber and the terrible, terrible events of Patriots Day in Massachusetts a while back has been the dominant conversation subject in talk radio. I'm correct in that assumption, aren't I?
Without question.
And one of the things that came out of it is how the media, it comes out of any major story, but this one in particular, because it was such a media watch, how the media performs with stories of major interest that involve mysterious aspects and breaking news. And what's your take on how the media handled it and what lessons have come to the fore?
Well, one of the interesting phenomena that we're seeing recently, and it was really best exemplified most recently by the Boston case, is that traditional media, in order to catch up, if you will, to the new social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc., is rushing even harder and faster to get the facts out first, feeling that they're in competition, and is therefore doing something that we haven't seen as much of in the past, which is making mistakes. And it's simply because they're trying to rush to get to get the news out as quickly as possible, all the while not realizing that people are broadcasting mistakes, if you will, across Twitter and Facebook, and it's affecting all the media. In order to get that out quickly, as much information as we can, especially in a fast-breaking, difficult-to-cover story like the Boston situation, where there was a manhunt and so on, it creates a flurry of activity in the media and in the news-gathering organizations, and they rush to the air or whatever, and there were a number of mistakes made, high-profile mistakes.
My observation of that is that even though within the media and within the journalism sector of the media, they're saying, we are going to slow down, we are going to make it right as opposed to first, that's still not happening. And,
no.
it's not about to. The pressure to get the story out first supersedes the pressure to get it right, and it's only after you mess up do you apologize and
yeah.
say we're going to do it right from now on. Would you agree that this is going to be around for a long time to come?
It is. I don't see how it's going to end, because there are a lot of things that were, a lot of information that was disseminated that was accurate,
right.
and that was done quickly,
exactly.
both by the traditional media and via social media. So, you know, the broadcasters, news gatherers see that happening, and they're willing to take a chance knowing they're going to get about 75% of it right.
Yeah, and it's all part of the sometimes painful adjustments we're making as we go from 20th century to 21st century culture.
Sure.
Kevin Casey, the Executive Vice President of Talkers Magazine, Executive Editor, thank you so much for joining us. Kevin is also a senior correspondent on our program. If you're interested in what's going on behind the scenes in the talk radio business, check it out, talkers.com. Steve Wiseman joins us next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
Hi, this is Jerry Rice. All kids have dreams. Mine was to play professional football. But for some, a medical problem might stand in the way. That's why Shriners Hospitals are so important. Shriners is a network of 22 hospitals providing some of the world's best orthopedic and burn medical care, totally free of charge. And there's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area. If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055 for more information. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage, when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
There are a ton of social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. This one saves lives. It's MatchingDonors.com. MatchingDonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you're someone in need of an organ transplant, visit MatchingDonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life, MatchingDonors.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're going to be joined the rest of this hour by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. Coming up now, Steve is in conversation with Dr. Norman Straker. He's one of the original faculty members of the very first psycho-oncology services under the leadership of Dr. Jimmy Holland at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and also teaches at Weill Cornell College of Medicine, Mount Sinai Medical Center, and the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. He's going to talk to Stephen about his new book titled Facing Cancer and the Fear of Death, A Psychoanalytical Perspective on Treatment, published by Jason Aronson, Incorporated.
You know, I don't mean to be crass right off the start, but one of the things that we deal with in death is we seem to throw a lot of money at curing diseases at a time when they can't be cured. Is that just my perception, or is that a reality?
Steve, you've hit the nail on the head. It's one of the great problems in our society right now, and one of the issues that we all have to face as a country, because we are spending ourselves into oblivion. And part of that has to do with what we call futile care at the end of life. So there is this kind of charade that occurs with many patients and their physicians, where the physicians don't bring up the subject of the fact that the patient's illness is incurable, and the patients don't ask. The treatments continue indefinitely until the patient ends up in the ICU. Money is just thrown down the toilet on all kinds of tests, partly to avoid malpractice. And yes, you're absolutely right. This is one of the issues that we have to come to and face as a country.
And this is not something that is doing the patient any service, because if the patient is going to die, it would seem that being able to face that, deal with that, and all the issues surrounding that, rather than just turning it into denial, might be something that would be easier and better for the patient and the patient's family.
Steve, there's no question that what you're saying is true. In fact, if your listeners and you are looking at People magazine or listening to any of the interviews of Valerie Harper, you can see that what she is going through, which is, you know, accepting the fact that she's going to die and dealing with it in a way that is actually quite helpful to her and to her family. She is not going to end up with unnecessary treatment. She's going to live the last days of her life exactly in the way that she wants, surrounded by her family, her friends, and she's also using the time in a very meaningful way, which many patients do if they're given the opportunity. She's using the time to teach the general public the fact that you don't have to be afraid of dying. Just what you need to do is live your life in the most meaningful way until you can't, you're not alive anymore.
You describe what you call death anxiety in the book. Could you explain that?
Right. Well, death anxiety is the anxiety we all have about even talking about death.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very, very prevalent, particularly in doctors, which is one of the things I try very hard to address in the book, because I'm most interested in attempting to have medical educators and doctors, senior doctors on the floor, help young doctors and medical students find a better way to cope with death and to deny it or avoid it, because that's what leads to this very thing that we talked about, this futile treatment at the end of life. And also, it interferes with patients having options like hospice or palliative care. And finally, I've seen many examples of this in my private practice, it affects doctors very badly, because they go through witnessing many patients have these terrible deaths, and then they get psychologically upset. So our neglecting death, or our letting death anxiety keep us from facing death, is doing nobody any good.
And hasn't seemed to make death go away yet, has it?
No, it hasn't. No, it hasn't. We all have to face it. We all have to deal with it at some point. And what I'm trying to do is make it less frightening and scary, and give people the opportunity to think about how they want to die or how they want to live their last months and weeks.
Now, you talk about a great deal in the book about flexibility, which is always a good thing. What would a flexible approach to patients facing death be?
Well, a flexible approach would mean that what you have to keep in mind is who the patient is, how they want to deal with it. Some people clearly are quite religious, and they want to speak about their feelings about how God will take care of them. Other people are have no religious feelings at all, and you have to help them face the end of their life in the way that they wish to do. And the other aspect of this is, as a therapist who does this sort of thing, you have to keep in mind that patients are at one and the same time aware of the incurability of their disease, and at another times they deny that they're going to die. So they move in and out of accepting and denying their own expected expiration date. And what you want to do is really help them to live the best way they can in the most meaningful way they can in the last weeks of their life.
One question that, now looking at this, is the third party. How do you offer support to a friend or a family member with a terminal illness?
Most importantly, you try the best you can to be as normal as you could be. In other words, one of the problems that patients have who are facing death is that they often feel that they have to help their friend be a friend because mm-hmm. they're so reluctant to approach them. In other words, a lot of friends will avoid a friend of theirs who's dying. And so it's best to try to be as upfront as possible with, how are you doing? I'm here for you. The friend may not know exactly what to say.
Yeah.
It's not about what you say. It's that you show up and that you're there.
You mentioned hospice and palliative care. Is it being used more? And is it? I mean, we had this in used hospice with my mother a couple of years ago, and it was a very positive experience for her and the family. Do you think it's being used enough, or what can we do to encourage this?
Well, I think that's exactly right. It's not being used enough, and it is extremely helpful because the alternative is what I call the futile care that ends up having patients die in the ICU. I don't know if you've ever visited an ICU, but it is an incredibly impersonal place.
Yeah.
It's full of people who are in coma or half aware. They have tubes in every orifice. There are all kinds of machines keeping people alive. And there's really no quality of life for the patient and the relatives and family and friends really don't have any time with their dying dear friend or family member. So, yes, hospice is underutilized and a very good experience, as you yourself can attest to.
I guess in summation, if your advice to the mental health professionals and physicians would be what in regard to changing the structure we have right now?
Well, I think it would be in general terms that they need to accept the fact that they are not failures if they can't keep their patients alive. I think we're taught in medical school that our main job is to keep people from dying or to cure disease. And we're not taught enough that the old family doctor and some of the kinds of values that doctor brought to the patient are that you have to care for the patient, not just cure the patient. So if the patient isn't going to survive, you have to be able to talk with them about facing their death and what it is that they want in the last days and weeks of their life. So I would say that first we have to think about supporting young doctors on the floor, that is the older attendings, helping them to help their patients face death by helping them to learn how to talk to their patients about these issues. And secondly, we have to support them because they get very frightened and they're very uneasy about talking about these issues. And when they lose their patients, they get very upset, so we need to support them. And if we don't support them, they tend to avoid, the next experience of talking to the patient when they think they're going to die. So that would be one aspect. The other is we need to change the medical school curriculum such that death is a subject that is in the curriculum.
That's Dr. Norman Straker in conversation with Steve Wiseman. His book is titled Facing Cancer and the Fear of Death, A Psychoanalytical Perspective on Treatment, published by Jason Arison Incorporated. Steve Wiseman returns in a moment on A Touch of Gray.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor seat, and we come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast. We're joined again, as promised, by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, Stephen J.J. Wiseman, Esquire. He's an attorney, and he is a fighter against fraud and scams. He is the webmaster of Scamicide.com. He's written the book, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall, and he's here now to talk about the Federal Trade Commission's action against mortgage scammers. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, when you get a letter from the government saying, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, you're always just a little bit wary. When that letter also contains a check, then I'm really going to be nervous. But believe it or not, this time it's true. The Federal Trade Commission is mailing out more than 13,000 refund checks to consumers who were deceived by a company that said it would negotiate with lenders to modify their mortgages and make them more affordable. So to resolve the FTC charges, the company, in this case its First Universal Lending, agreed to an order banning them from any further mortgage relief services and also agreeing to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to return to consumers. You know, there's a number of lessons here. First of all, if you're one of the thousands of people who did work with First Universal Lending, and you haven't gotten a check, you can call the refund administrator, which is at 1-888-251-6825, or go to the FTC, because the FTC will often have refunds for people who have been scammed by various entities and companies and people whom the FTC has taken action against. So you go to the FTC's website, but a special part of it, www.ftc.gov/refunds, and you'll be able to find out if there is a refund that's coming to you. But this in particular, you know, the scammers out there take advantage of absolutely everything that is going on, and mortgage relief scams right now are very, very prevalent, and they make sense. There are a lot of people who have fallen behind in their mortgages, are looking for some help, and so they're turning to these companies that are advertising everywhere for mortgage relief. They give you a half-truth, sometimes outright lies about what they're going to do for you. Maybe they're going to give you counseling. Maybe they're going to do what they call a forensic audit, where they look at your mortgage documents to see if the lender complied with the law. Other times they're going to say they're going to negotiate with the bank for you. Now, the rules regarding mortgage modification and mortgage assistance relief services are pretty strict. And it's illegal for a company to charge you anything unless they have given you a written offer for a loan modification or other relief from your lender. So they have to have completed the work, and you have to accept the offer. Watch out for telemarketers, because telemarketers are one of the ways that they do this a lot. If you do have trouble with your mortgage and you're having problems, what you really want to do is not go to one of these services, but what you want to do is talk to a lawyer. And a lawyer can help you with this out. They know what they're doing. They're able to negotiate on your behalf, and they're going to comply with the law. So be careful. Check with the FTC if you have been scammed, and you know, be a little skeptical. Trust me, you can't trust anyone.
Thank you very much, Steve Wiseman. Again, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall, and the website scamaside.com. Steve Wiseman, one of the people on our program, and we thank him. We thank Beverly Santinello, our producer. We certainly thank Carol Marks, the host and founder of the show, Kevin Casey, and the entire Touch of Gray broadcast team. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.